Welcome to the Potter Marsh Fall Podcast, an audio tour of one of Alaska's most popular wildlife viewing spots. In this podcast, brought to you by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Audubon Alaska, we'll learn about swans, the fall bird migration, and also about wetland plants, which form the base of the food chain at Potter Marsh. This is Ken Flynn, your host, and with us is Tom Rothe, Waterfowl Program Coordinator at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Well, here we are at Potter Marsh. It's early October. We've already had our first snow this fall, so migratory birds, especially waterfowl, are leaving the country, and by usually mid-October, we're totally frozen with fresh water. So this is about a good time to see geese and swans leaving for lower 48.
It's cold out, about 25 degrees, and winter is quickly approaching. Many birds have already headed south, but not some swans and ducks. Why are they still here?
The fall use of Potter Marsh by swans and other birds is to just stop by for food for a short while, sometimes just for a few days. Depends on the weather. Usually birds wait for a nice north or west wind that'll help push them along, and they'll take off. So most of these birds start in September, October, rotate through here pretty quickly. But the swans will linger for quite a while, and usually just before freeze-up, all that's left is mallards. And of course, we have mallards that spend the whole winter in Anchorage, but mallards are always the northernmost, hardiest birds left as the winter comes on.
Many people think of swans when they think of fall at Potter Marsh. That's when you can often see big groups swimming gracefully out in the water.
We're lucky to get two kinds of swans here. We have the trumpeter swan, which is a local breeder in Cook Inlet. These are birds that are adapted to forest wetlands and lakes. Probably the largest flying member of the waterfowl family at 20 pounds or more. But they'll breed in Cook Inlet, nesting as early as May and producing youngsters that are barely able to fly sometimes in September. During spring and fall migration, we get tundra swans that are headed toward western Alaska, the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta and other points in Bristol Bay. These are smaller birds, about 12 pounds, they'll spend their whole summer in western Alaska and then come back through usually between mid-September and mid-October.
So the large groups of 10, 20 or more are usually tundra swans. How else can you tell tundra and trumpeter swans apart?
Just for viewers, it's sometimes difficult to tell them apart. The tundra swan actually has a little yellow in front of the eye, if you can see it, but it's variable. But the big clue is their voices. The large trumpeter swan has a voice like a French horn, and they're usually found just in family groups with two or three youngsters. Tundra swans coming through Cook Inlet and Potter Marsh here are usually in larger groups, and they have kind of a whooping call. It's a little higher pitched call, so that's the giveaway if you hear them calling or if you can see them side by side.
Now we're down at the south end of Potter Marsh, near the stands of bulrushes and the open pond. We're looking right now at a group of trumpeter swans, plus some widgeons and mallards.
The swans are using their feet to tread up bottom material, and then they go down and feed on it themselves while the ducks pick up the remaining bits. The south part of the marsh is kind of interesting because it's mostly bulrush with open pools, and I think it's a little deeper, which means it's better habitat for swans, diving ducks like canvasbacks and scaup. But that's actually fairly different from the north end of the marsh, where it's tidally influenced with inlet water.
And that brings to mind the plants, the reason the birds are here. Here with us to talk about the base of the food chain is Mary Lee Plamentius, a plant ecologist and wetlands expert with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. While Potter Marsh is primarily a coastal freshwater marsh, the tides bring salt water into parts of the marsh. That salt affects which plants can grow. Can you explain how that works?
Over by the culvert, by the old boardwalk, you still have the sea coming in, and depending on the height of the tide, you have it spreading out a further or shorter distance. And with it come all the salts that are with the sea and all of the nutrients. And then also nutrients leave from the marsh and go out to the sea. And the plants, some of them really like being in that kind of ever-changing salt situation, and some of them don't like it. And the way you can tell which is which is that when you look over by the old boardwalk near the culvert, you can see which sedges are present, and they really like it. Whereas something like the sweetgale, that's off on the margins, way far away from where the tide comes.
And interestingly, Potter Marsh hasn't always been a freshwater marsh. Tell us about that.
People tend to think that what's right in front of them has always been this way. And this once was part of the sea. It used to look the way it looks over on the other side of the railroad tracks. That was way back in 1916 when, inadvertently, with no intention of creating a marsh, went and put an embankment across to be able to carry the railroad. And then here's the marsh starting to develop, and now it's one of the largest freshwater marshes that we have. It's really amazing.
Back down at the south end of the marsh, we met B.B. Chang, a photographer who braved the cold and noise on the Seward Highway today to photograph the swans.
I moved here 2 years ago, and I didn't like Anchorage at all at the beginning until I found the Potter Marsh. A lot of wild birds here, and spent a lot of time here since spring, artichokes, milgo, and this is a bird's heaven.
Yes, this is bird's heaven. Tom, we have time for one last question. I'm curious. Do swans really mate for life, like they say?
The old story of swans mating for life is mostly true, but if they have a mate that's not doing their job or they're not compatible, they'll reassort themselves. So. But swans are very faithful to each other, stay together all year long, and have a interesting set of signals, head bobbing, and every once in a while wing flapping and mutual calling, which is a bonding ritual that swans and sandhill cranes have too.
That's the end of our fall podcast. Thanks to Tom Rothy and Mary Lee Plumentius for leading us on this audio tour, and to B.B. Chang for sharing her enthusiasm for photographing the wildlife here. These podcasts have been generously funded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and we also thank the Bird Treatment and Learning Center for their support. Check back with us in winter when most of the birds have departed, but other wildlife remain and employ clever strategies to survive winter in a frozen marsh.